Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This week, Mitt Romney becomes the first Mormon to be nominated for president by a major political party. And we thought that the time was appropriate to talk about Mormonism. Our guest this hour, documentary film writer Jane Barnes, says that she somehow reached her 40s without ever having met a single Mormon and knowing almost nothing about our homegrown prophet. But certainly that changed. In 2003, she signed on as a writer for a PBS series about the Mormons. She said she'd been fascinated by the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith for some time, long enough to feel that she wasn't going to be suddenly swept away by him. But she had her own conversion experience in working on all of this. She says she met him roaming the corridors of American history in Fawn Brody's No Man Knows My History, portrayed as a genius who would be comfortable at the same table with P.T. Barnum, Walt Disney, and Norman Mailer. Joining us this hour is Jane Barnes, and Jane is author of Falling in Love with Joseph Smith. Jane has published two novels. She has written a number of essays and stories and has written documentaries for American Experience, American Masters, and Frontline. We'll be welcoming phone calls for her. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Jane. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, certainly the time has come to talk about Joseph Smith, hasn't it? We now are paying more attention to Mormonism.
We certainly are, and I think Joseph Smith is a fabulous place to start. He's a very vivid, underrated, and original American.
You write early in the book, if only Mark Twain had written a book about the young Joseph, you would have liked to have read that, I'm sure. Why Mark Twain?
Well, I just always had this feeling about the young Joseph is that he was the third boy in the Mark Twain's pantheon of American boys. I mean, there was, you know, Tom with his gorgeous imagination, but who was really a very conventional boy. Then there was Huck, who was a very unconventional and wounded sympathetic outsider, and then there was Joseph Smith, the religious visionary with no respect for the rules. And he had that poetic energy and joyfulness that those boys had. And Mark Twain was born after Joseph Smith, but still it was a frontier they shared.
Did Mark Twain write about Mormonism?
He did. He made a lot of jokes at their expense. Although he was fascinated by them. I mean, the famous joke is that he said enduringly that the Book of Mormon was chloroform in print. And in Roughing It, involved his own trips west, he wrote a lot about being in Salt Lake City and in Brigham Young's time, and he was fascinated by it. It was a beautifully laid out city. He felt that the whole polygamy experiment was also very exotic and kind of cast a spell, but primarily he wasn't drawn to them.
Let's talk a little bit about your interest in matters of faith. You, the way that you grew up, because part of the book, a large part of the book, is what you were going through as well, being open perhaps to a conversion experience, being captivated by this young man, by the Book of Mormon. Would you consider yourself a woman who was on a spiritual journey for a good portion of your life?
Well, you know, the truth is, I was a religious child. I went to the Episcopalian Church probably until I was about 8 or 9, and then we moved from Rhode Island, where my parents had enforced children going to church, though they did not. And we moved to Washington with my father's job, and my parents stopped enforcing going to church. And I did persist. I mean, I had a religious interest, but I felt like the odd man out, and I was taking a taxi to church, which made me feel like a total weirdo. So I stopped going to church then, but that was important to me, and even more important to me, actually, were the childhood experiences in nature, in the country, with my friends, in the summer, where there was just this beauty over everything, and that actually I think even then I understood that as children we were like these privileged creatures in a world where we were free, and actually then we could feel safe, and there was this wonder of being with each other and the sense of urgency and being just much more than these people of a certain age with grades in a school, that we were involved in some angelic, enterprise. And then when I was older, I mean, I did nothing. I mean, when I was a young adult, I did start to want. I did start to seek, but I wasn't finding. And I went back to the Episcopalian Church. I didn't like it. I mean, it was too kind of cool and detached for me. And I tried other things. I think as an adult, what I tried the longest was, and studied the longest, was Zen meditation. And but the longer I meditated, the more I wanted to pray, and the more I wanted to pray, the less I had to say. And so I was sort of at an impasse. And it wasn't happening for me when I put myself out. I don't think I really had an active sense that I've got to find something. But then when I continued to read, and one of the books I read was a book by Fawn Brody about Joseph, and he just spoke to me. I mean, I just felt his youth, and especially in childhood, I felt his irreverence and his having a sense that I remembered so well from my own childhood. And so at that point, you know, I could say, well, I have been a seeker because now I have found, and I just was lucky that I lived long enough to find.
Mm-hmm. You also write about you loved his divinely irreverent sense of humor. It isn't often that you think about religion and faith and sense of humor. Maybe we should think more about that. But he had that for you, a sense of humor?
Oh, yeah, incredible. And actually, I think, you know, I feel like it's one of the reasons that people haven't understood him. But I say he's part of the frontier. You can't be in the frontier and be hopelessly pious. I mean, and if you are hopelessly pious, you will be missing the spirit of your times. I think he had wonderful humor at me in the very beginning. You know, he was involved in the magic culture, and the magic culture involved having a peepstone and looking in the, this wasn't the only thing, but this is the big thing, looking into the peepstone, which was opaque, but somehow seeing in it buried treasure. And everyone tried it. Everyone wanted to find buried treasure in their backyard. And Joseph, actually, I think he had more charisma than luck in finding treasure. But, for instance, at one point he buried, as a way of attracting clients, and this really reminds me of Tom Sawyer, he buried a pheasant feather, which he then looked in, and then his clients arrived. And he looked into his peeper stone and saw that when they began to dig in a certain spot, they would first find a pheasant feather, and underneath that would be the chest of gold.
Yes.
The people dug, they found the pheasant feather, they found no trunk of gold, but he looked in his stone again and said, oh, that's too bad. There have been dead Indians who have moved the chest. Now, you cannot do this without having a sense of humor, and it's like Tom Sawyer, you know, saying to people that he'll show them his sore toe if they paint the fence. I mean, it's wonderful. And then I think even when you come to the hat, and I know this may sound too irreverent, but I don't think it is. You know, he was a poor boy. He had to use what was at hand. He, as he moved into his religious calling, which I really believe was real, you know, he began to parlay the magic culture into his religious vision. And he found, with the gold plates, these holy spectacles, which had peepstones in them. And he put them in the hat, and then he put his face in the hat, and he read a translation at the bottom of the hat of a language he called Reformed Egyptian. And this became the Book of Mormon. And, I mean, and you think of the poetry of Mark Twain's humor, that, and I feel it there, that it's just, it's divine, and in the culture, I mean, think of all the ways that hat was still in usage, or then in usage, old hat, new hat, in a cocked hat, he was about to throw everything into a cocked hat with the Book of Mormon and pulling a rabbit from the hat, just to, for starters. Mm-hmm. And he, the world was in, Christianity was up for grabs, and he pulled new scripture out of his hat. And I don't think any, I adored it. I just responded to it. I felt it. I felt he was like a modern artist. I felt he was like not Moses, but Thelonious Monk in a rapture. I mean, he was having a great time. He was improvising. He was experimenting. He was finding a new form of Christianity in a brand new world.
There may be other people in the audience who, like you, have reached their 40s or beyond, or, and not known very much about the homegrown prophet or known much about peepstones. So we're going to get some basic information here. And, oh, our caller is gone. She wanted to know how a religion came from peepstones. But can you explain some of the terminology here? Because some people will hear peepstones and say, what in the world is she talking about?
Well, peepstones were special stones which individuals found for themselves and felt they had sympathy with or a relation to, and that peepstone in the right hands could be used to see treasure in other places. If you held a peepstone in your hand and looked at it, you would see that there was gold coin buried in neighbor Smith's backyard. That's really the extent of it. And there were other magic tools. There were rods that were set up in certain ways that would vibrate according to the person who was looking. And when they vibrated, that meant there was valuable treasure there. You know, treasure diggers still exist. There have been actually a couple. It's a sort of ancient art or science, whichever. And, you know, there have been some newspaper stories in the last 6 months of men in, I thought it was the Midwest. I could have that wrong. But it's, you know, well, first of all, in Palmyra, there were many ancient relics from the American Indians there. Mm-hmm. And then there is the dream of gold. And the, as I say, the magic culture had long been the folk, kind of common folk procedure, way of going about things and deciding how you did, you know, what you were going to eat or who you were going to marry and all those things. But it was very mixed in with religion. There wasn't a great distinction, although in Joseph's time that distinction was coming into existence.
Hmm. So how does it translate into religion? So if you've got this peepstone and you find the treasure, what are you supposed to do with it? How does it translate into do good works or whatever it translates into?
Well, I think the first way it translates into religion is that your imagination is set on invisible things.
Hmm.
Your imagination is rich, not just with hope, but vision. The average man, you know, came along and had a peepstone and was practicing seeing buried treasure in that peepstone. So, I mean, his imagination was stimulated, but it was stimulated visually. You know, he had the trees that the chests were buried under were, he had to see it specifically, and some people had more talent than others. Some people were more imaginative than others. And I think that people in our day, although I don't have this problem, and I'd be interested in any comments that people have. I mean, you know, there was no TV, there was no movies, there was no. We live in this visual hurricane, where you know we're just being bombarded, and sometimes wonderfully, and sometimes deafeningly, and sometimes deadeningly, you know, by imagery. So, I mean, I think my imagination is not very visual. But I think in the 19th century, people's, on the frontier, and I would be able to talk about that more than other places.
Right.
You know, that they there was so much they didn't have in their lives. And especially the poor people, poor farmers, such as Joseph's family, they're dreaming, they're hoping, and they believe in God, and so they feel that somewhere between the peepstone and God in heaven, who, you know, they hope is rooting for them, they imagine this, these things in the invisible world, in the unseen world, which are going to help and make them rich. And when I think Joseph parlays that into religion, I think he just raises the goal of magic. It's no longer to find money. And he, you know, when people distrust him and say, oh, he was a con man, he was trying to make money. What, he never made any money. I mean, he made less money as a religious seeker and a man who, a young man who saw God and saw an angel come into his bedroom and imagined the gold plates and then looked into the hat. He made no money. His mind had risen to the occasion of God and envisioning God and envisioning a book about God in the new world.
Did you, Jane, almost become a Mormon?
I did.
Because?
Well, actually, you know, I do feel like this incredible sympathy with Joseph Smith. And he actually has just changed my life in the sense that, you know, I feel that I made a connection with God through him. And it was not just, by the way, through, you know, loving the boy and then really admiring the Book of Mormon. But I did, at the end of the film, have a kind of classic conversion experience. I was on the road in a car. I was lost. I was trying to find my way. I was getting lost, and then I would find myself, and it was lost and found and lost and found, and then all of a sudden I found my way. I saw that I was in the right place, and I just had this unbelievable, shattering experience, the fundamental core of which was a reassurance that everything here was a half-finished sentence that would be finished on the other side. So those were, I mean, so between the power of Joseph and his way, I mean, you know, he's sort of like somebody who's showing you an approach. We have the world where God is everywhere. He's in our hats. He's in our stones. He's in our backyard. And that we don't have to be so, you know, perfect in terms of going to church and, you know, kneeling on our pews. That doesn't have to mean that's not the only way that God comes to us. And then, for whatever reason, he spoke to my own religious hunger and aspiration.
Jane Burns, our guest this hour, her book is Falling in Love with Joseph Smith, My Search for the Real Prophet. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and she describes in this book, which is also a great deal about Jane Burns, who's had a fascinating life, her experiences working on the PBS series on Mormonism as she moved almost to the brink of Mormonism, with an experience that she briefly described right now. But she knows a great deal about the faith, and this week, as Mitt Romney becomes the first Mormon to be considered as president of the United States, it seemed appropriate that we would learn more about this faith. So to you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, it's back to school time, and we'll be speaking with a history professor about the syllabus. Is it a story or a contract? And we'll talk about the way that we teach history. That's tomorrow at this hour. All right, we go to phone calls. We have many of them for Jane Burns. We start our calls with Robert in Madison. Hi, Robert.
Hello, is it me?
Yes, it's you, Robert.
Ah, great. Thank you for having me. Two things. First, I'd recommend a book by two Mormon professors of sociology called Could I Vote for a Mormon for President, which describes a lot of the issues, I think, that are important. Very fair-handed. For instance, they argue that Mormonism is not a cult, but they're also honest about the peculiarities of the Mormon religion. And the second thing is, Romney can't win without the evangelical Christian community. And I wonder if any of them would vote for him if they knew that a basic Mormon tenet is that God used to be a man, became a god, now lives with his wife on a planet in the star system Kolob, and that a good Mormon, when he dies, can likewise ascend to the Godhead, become a god, and have his own universe to rule.
Jean.
No, that's a question for me. You know, I think it's totally problematic and that they wouldn't vote and for a Mormon president, unless they dislike the current president so much they feel they have to replace him. That I mean, I feel that the Christians, the traditional Christians and the evangelical Christians who feel so strongly about the ways in which Mormonism isn't Christian, I don't know that anyone has been able to do polls on how many people, how many traditional Christians and evangelicals will not vote for a Mormon. Hmm. I heard last night on NPR that there's a consistent percentage of 47%, and that percentage is apparently over decades, of people who feel that Mormonism is weird, though that's not the same thing as saying that they're not going to vote for Romney. And and actually, the caller may in fact.
He's gone. Thank you, Robert, for the call. So as a presidential candidate, when he is introduced, it's obviously very true. I read a book, the Boston Globe people, who did a book about his life, not just his faith, but his faith plays a huge role in that particular book, and the authors have covered him for years and years. It governs his weeks. It governs his charitable contributions. It governs how he deals with community. Does he need to, you think, explain, or is this such a foreign religion to us that he just couldn't do it justice in an acceptance speech or talking about it on the road? Is he best to just let people wonder?
You know, I think it's a good question. I mean, in some sense, I think he's had success in not talking about it, because every time anyone brings it up in public, then it's the chorus of, oh, the holy underwear, oh, you know, the planet called Kolob, et cetera. And by just not allowing the conversation, you know, it has disappeared, or it has not been around me, and people constantly were bringing it up in last fall. I think he has a hard, I think he's got a bigger problem for not having talked about it. But it is also a hard thing to do. I mean, think of Obama dealing with Reverend Wright's racist sermons during the last campaign.
Yes.
And he did such a brilliant job of handling it. And part of the reason he could handle it is that the discussion about blacks and whites in America and the problem of racism in America was very, very developed. So he was talking to a country who, for the most part, understood what he was saying, and that is, in our long history of racist difficulty and struggle, we've come far, but we still have feelings and anger towards each other. I think he even acknowledged anger, which we now only express in private, which is for the kitchen. Now, Romney, if he could get up and say, well, we have a long history of realizing that some people think Mormonism is weird,
mm-hmm.
and yet we, the Mormons, have done nothing but succeed, and we're still coming into our own. I don't think that's a commonly held discussion. Do you know what I mean? In other words,
yes.
People have to invent
right. The
narrative at this point. And it's very hard to do because of this problem, that so much of it has not been worked through our common sense of who the Mormons are to us.
Our guest this hour is Jean Barnes. Her book is Falling in Love with Joseph Smith, My Search for the Real Prophet. Let's go to Ted in Madison next. Hi, Ted.
Hi. You know, I was just rereading parts of John Krakauer's book yesterday, Under the Banner of Heaven, which also gives a background Mormonism as a sort of an underlay for the rest of the book. And having read that, it occurred to me that in these days, Joseph Smith probably would have been prosecuted as a fraud and ended up on the sex offender registry list. You know, so many of his multiple wives that he took were of an age, adolescent, and it's just remarkable to me that, you know, I have this visceral reaction to the story, and yet the author came away with it from a different perspective altogether. And I'm just wondering, you know, if you could imagine yourself being a wife of Joseph Smith, I mean, how would that affect your perspective? And what do you think about the fact that so many of the fundamentalist sects sort of base themselves on, you know, Smith's model and marry teenage girls?
Yeah.
You know, they're not out there looking for 40-year-old wives.
Interesting question here. Which, Jane?
Yeah.
Take it on.
Okay. So let me say a couple of things. I gather that part of what the caller is saying is something that I'm very aware of, which is that he has had a very negative feeling about Joseph Smith, and I have had a very positive experience. And this is one of the weird facts about Joseph, and I don't know how to explain it, and I really don't. I don't think I've figured out a proper solution to it. He is a very divisive character. I mean, people, you know, deplore and hate him, and people love and embrace him. So that, you know, that fact that, I mean, that he is, that he that he's so just in naturally controversial is a fact. I mean, it just happens. And I don't know, when people have a visceral dislike for him, you know, I don't know if I can persuade them. Let me tell you what, persuade them that there's anything of value in Joseph Smith, or that when it's visceral, it's sort of like not, it's beyond right and wrong. I mean, it's like my being viscerally for him. It's, you know, it's just the way it is. That's how I reacted. But let me try and say this about polygamy, and I have to comment on Krakauer's book as I talk about it. Actually, Krakauer is one of the great writers living, and he's such a page turner, and he can compel you to believe every word he says. I do feel that in that book, he starts out with a visceral dislike for Joseph Smith, which he writes very persuasively. And the part of the, and so he starts at the beginning, and just for him, the hat, the peepstones, all those things are just ridiculous, and they're fake, and they're conning. And there's no religion there. So that if you start with the feeling that Joseph is not a religious person, then polygamy is especially hard to understand. And, you know, I don't have an inherent horror of polygamy. I find it sort of extraordinary that he tried it. And I know full well that as he tried it, who often spoke of the difference between the prophet and the man and said, when I speak as a prophet, I am a prophet, and when I speak as a man, I'm a man, that he, who knew well the difference in himself between the visionary prophet and the weak man, he was tempted to behave as badly as possible during polygamy, and he did behave very badly. Now, let me just make one point, which is his youngest wives were 14, and at that time, the marriage age was legally 12. We do live in another time in relation to law and the and marriage and the age of when a woman is, you know, able to make the decision to have sex, et cetera. And that is something to take into account. I think that when you ask me what I would think, actually, you know, the truth is, I was a teenager in the 60s. I never experienced group marriage or tried it, but I was sort of fascinated by it, and I thought that for instance, in Thy Neighbor's Wife, the book by, I'm going to forget his name, but he's a great, Gay Talese, there are two groups in there who experiment and start out with single marriages and go through several marriages and have a group relationship, and actually they seem like very intelligent, very strong, very interesting people who've changed in an interesting way as a result of their consensual relationship. That may not be the same thing, but anyway, it's a way of saying that I did have. I don't react automatically against polygamy.
Mm-hmm.
And let me say one other thing, and that is in the course of trying to introduce polygamy, which he did do, Joseph did do probably too quickly and in a sort of messy way where he was having a secret from some people and not others. He did tell his wife. She hated the idea. She fought with him. She was a very admirable woman. She was a very smart woman, and everyone praised her for her judge of character. And actually, at one point, someone in that period said to her, "Do you believe he's a real prophet of God?" And she said, "I do, but I wish I didn't. Which I think is interesting. Anyway, they had some very tremendous battles in their marriage, and finally, she seems to have fought him at least to a draw. And in the last 8 months of his life, he did not take on any other plural wife. There's no actual explanation anyway, but there's reason. I mean, he'd been, you know, he had in the last few years married, say, 6-5 more women. But he stopped altogether. And during that time, he is reported to have said to a friend that polygamy must stop because it's going to be the ruin of our people. So I think that's of interest.
Thank you, Ted, for the call. And what about considering the fact that a lot of people have the visceral reaction that Ted has to polygamy, how do Mormons now deal with the legacy of Joseph Smith? Is he still considered a prophet? Is he buried in service? Where is he in the Mormon faith right now?
Well, that's a good question. I think he's sort of distanced. I think there was a very painful break the people as a group had very, in a very loyal way, had taken up polygamy and practiced it and been horribly punished. I mean, the church was practically beaten to death in Utah. I mean, they were, and in fact, it became the test case for our religious freedom as a result of the laws raised against polygamy and the number of people jailed for polygamy in the 19th century. Religious freedom for America became defined as you can believe in anything, but you can't do anything. And that was, it was very, very painful to take up. It was very, very painful to put down. And I think people just have a kind of dividing line between themselves and Joseph because at this point you're excommunicated in the mainstream church if you practice polygamy. So, I mean, I think if I had become Mormon, if I were Mormon, I would try and, I would understand it was painful. I think I would try and keep the door open because of well, first of all, I think there is the creative spirit of the early Joseph. Then I think there's the mystery of, what happened to him. I mean, I think polygamy was not his finest hour. And yet, I do have sympathy with it. I remain sympathetic to him. And part of it is I'm not sorry to have a prophet who's so badly behaved because it helps me sort of know that he's a person, too, and struggling with all his vanity and all these impatience, et cetera.
Let's go to another caller. Okay. Sue in, where are you, Sue? Bailey Harbor?
I'm Bailey's Harbor.
Bailey's Harbor. Hi.
Hi. I just wondered, I have a friend, a close friend who's a Mormon, and the problem I have with the Mormon beliefs are their thoughts on women and the fact that it doesn't seem like you can get to heaven unless you're really dependent to get to heaven on your husband and your family and, you know, essentially what they do. I don't know if there's any way that you can get to heaven, like, on your own unless you're a part of a marriage and a family.
I think that, I mean, the quick answer to that is it's not true in fact. I mean, there were single women that I met during the film, women who had very high jobs in Mormon life, and they all said that they actually, I mean, not they all, some of them, I think, had a reasonable attitude towards being single, and that was that, and they expected to go to heaven as practicing Mormons. I know some of them actually thought that they would have a husband in heaven for them. I think the idea of the depression is very high among Mormon women. However, I think there's also, we don't know the Mormon community well enough, and there are many, you know, powerhouse women there teaching, writing, doing businesses, being, entering every part of life, and they probably are not in the same percentage as they are in outside Mormonism, but I would say that it's not as bad as the PR says.
But it's one of the reasons, the place of women, that you decided not to do the conversion?
Not, in fact. Actually, the thing was is that when I went to the Mormon church, I was really trying to affirm, and my first question was, have I truly got my hands on God? I mean, do I really believe? And when I was in the church, I loved the services. They're organized around testimony, and people talk about their experiences with God and Revelation. And I was very moved by that. It was moving to be with people who were like me, you know, just ordinary people trying to figure out what God is and what the experience of God is. But I think when you go in and looking for God or trying to find how to pray or affirm God as your belief, your first question is not, what is your idea of women's role? And I met many blacks in the church who had joined the church before the ban had been lifted on blacks in the priesthood. And they all said, God trumps politics. And I think there's a mistaken idea that abroad in the liberal world that, you want a church which has your ideas. And I think it's more you want a church which has your faith. And at the same time, the doctrines actually were less problematic to me than the fact that you have to, pay lip service to them, or I felt I did. I mean, it was very hard to, and I don't know how, I mean, so I never really got as far as living in a culture, and living in a church culture where, I completely, went along as well as seemed to agree with things like being against same-sex marriage.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Ron in Madison. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, I'm living in Madison now, but I'm actually from Idaho, and I went to school in Utah, and as a young man, I was make my own search, and I spent 4.5 years studying the Mormon religion. So I could probably take up the whole program here, but I just want to focus in on one particular prophecy. First of all, I believe that Joseph Smith probably got his information, if he got from any spiritual being, from Satan, who he conveniently decided was a brother of Christ. But in 1844, the year he was killed, he was planning on running for president, and he conveniently came out with a prophecy that a Mormon would save the Constitution. And that's a concern for me now. John Kennedy was able to say that he was not going to take his orders from the Vatican because the Vatican didn't have a plan to run the country. But the Mormons do.
Jane.
I think this is actually a reason for honest concern. My way of saying it is that I feel that the Mormon Church has played fast and loose with its power in a number of key legislative issues since ERA. I mean, that was where they first came in, and they were fresh, they were new to it, and they broke a ton of rules. They were using the church, political literature and passing it out and busing women in to vote against ERA. They became, after that, very involved in the Hawaii and the Arizona same-sex marriage campaigns and poured money into that. It's not clear how much money they put in. And finally, as we all know, and was very public, they were deeply involved in Prop 8. And this is not good. I mean, it's really, especially with a church that is that rich and where the money is so hard to track because there's no external audit and they only have an internal audit. Mitt Romney's speech on religion never said a word about believing in the absolute separation of church and state, but John Kennedy in 1960, when he gave his speech, he made it absolutely clear and said the words, "I absolutely believe in the separation of church and state." And he said, backed it up in several other ways. So I think this is a problem, and I'm amazed that no one has asked Romney this question, and I can't help but feel that it will be asked him during the presidential debate.
And Joseph Smith was planning on running for president?
He was, and he had himself nominated by his apostles. And he actually wanted to run because of there had been so many, you know, when they were run out of Missouri, they lost property, they lost a lot of property, and they were never repaid, and he took the case to Van Buren, who said, "Your cause is just, but I can do nothing for you." And then while they were in Illinois, there were, you know, many other kinds of assaults and problems that the Mormons were subject to, and Joseph really wanted to I don't think he believed he would be elected president, but I think he wanted to make a statement about what he felt was the unfairness and injustice done to Mormons.
Our guest this hour is Jean Burns. Her book is Falling in Love with Joseph Smith, My Search for the Real Prophet. Her number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, during this hour, we're going to be announcing the first selection in our back-to-school book club. We decided that one year, an audience of avid readers, and one Wednesday each month during this school year, we're going to be talking about an American classic, one that influenced our history or reflected our history. So tomorrow at 10 o'clock, we'll announce the first selection, which we'll be talking about on September 26. I think it should be absolutely wonderful to have you read this book, and we'll talk about those books that are important, you know, on the list of books you need to read in your lifetime, and books that are important to who we are as Americans. So that announcement tomorrow at 10. I hope you'll participate. Let's go next to Joe in Princeton. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. I have a question on, I have a statement and a question. My understanding in the Mormon religion, in order to rise to the level of being a bishop, you have to be a successful businessman, and Mitt Romney has risen to that point. And as a bishop within the Mormon religion, you take an oath to the church that they will take precedence in your life above anything else. So if Mitt Romney were elected president, that oath of office would mean nothing because it would be superseded by his oath to the Mormon church. Second, according to the Mormon religion, they believe strongly that God speaks directly to them. And in Krakauer's book, Under the Banner of Heaven, this is about a murder where these kids thought that God was telling them to murder these people. And so they did it, and that was their defense in court. Now, if God speaks directly to Romney as president, he's got this oath, and he believes that God's speaking directly to him. If God tells him to invade Iran, there we go. And that'll supersede anything that the American people want. So I'm curious what your guests would say to that.
Well, it's my understanding that Romney is no longer a bishop, and that so that he's no longer bound by that oath. I think the other question, I think that is a question that also should come up. I mean, because this may not be if he loses, he won't be the last Mormon candidate, and that is, I mean, we need to have those questions answered about the role of the bishop. And I have had friends who've tried to write op-eds for the New York Times about that point, because of course we've never had a Catholic bishop as president either. So it's an important thing. But and so I, let me not answer. Let Romney answer. The thing about Revelation is, and the way it was portrayed in Krakauer's book, which was especially terrifying because the man who would receive the revelation to murder also was so rational in his thinking, or, you know, anyway, it was terrifying. I think there's a point there too, that if governed or shared, that if you have a revelation and you don't share it with anyone, or you aren't talking to people, or you don't reveal it to people who are, you know, people who might have a differing opinion, could be very dangerous. The Mormon Church is also all about, not just about revelation, but about getting advice about your revelations, seeking, you know, confirmation that your revelation is true. And I think that they are aware of the problem of a runaway revelation, and one of the reasons they were so slow to have the revelation about to be ready to receive the revelation about blacks and the priesthood was that, you know, that it took a long time for the revelation to simmer enough in the entire group of apostles that they could all receive the revelation together.
Thanks very much, Joe, for the call. Gloria in Barron. Hi.
I'm interested in your topic today. I didn't get in on the beginning of it, but I've always thought that if you wanted to really know the truth about something, you would ask the people that were involved in it. For instance, you would not look to Shakespeare to study chemistry.
True.
But I would think it's inquisitive to me that everybody wonders about the Mormon Church. Why don't they just ask the Mormons? We have 56,000 missionaries that are anxious to tell people about the Mormon religion.
I think you have a wonderful point, and when I first encountered Joseph, this was before the Olympics, which I think was kind of a benchmark, a changing point. There was no contact. I mean, I feel like the Mormons, for possibly reasons of just not wanting to encounter objection and rudeness. I mean, when we were making the film, I mean, so many people felt free to be rude to us. That, oh, why are you interested in the Mormons? I mean, it was very shocking to me, and it sort of showed me how unfair the world is, and free to feel unfair to the Mormons. I think after the Olympics, their visibility has grown. I think they've grown much more interested in trying to reach out to the rest of the world. And it's well known that most people who have experiences with the Mormons are kind of amazed by how kindly and loving and just like real human beings they are. So I think the Mormons do have some habit of, and also their church is very demanding. I mean, there are many hours every week that they need to give to different aspects of the church. But I think this will grow. I think the relationship between the communities will grow. And I think you're right. If you're interested in the Mormon, please go to the church and find the missionaries.
Mm-hmm. You discovered that you had people who were Mormons in your background that you didn't know anything about because of the emphasis on our ancestors that the Mormons have helped many people with. Did you find people?
I found lots of people.
Interesting.
I was so astounded. But actually, in some way, because of my own terrific response, I thought, well, I must, this can't, and I know that in my family, there are, you know, kind of people who've had passionate, upheavals and changes of mind and commitments and searches. So, I thought, well, you know, in some ways, we do have sort of a Mormon earnestness to us. And I found that the first person I found was Anna Barnes, and she was my father's eighth cousin, but in a direct line, and she had converted in 1833. And actually, her husband was a very prominent person in the church and was close to Joseph Smith, mm-hmm. and they moved to Nauvoo and were close to him. But then beyond that, I mean, there were just a number of people in my father's family. There was a woman who was related to his mother, and his mother was a woman from New York who was someone, I think she would have fainted if she'd known that her wonderful ancestor, Royal Barney's daughter, married Brigham Young.
Oh, my.
And then there was a person on my mother's side, and I love this person, too, that his name was Caleb Baldwin, who went to jail with Joseph after the Missouri War, and they were chained together in jail. And the jailers were saying to Caleb, if you renounce the Book of Mormon and you renounce Joseph Smith, we will set you free. And there he was, chained to Joseph Smith, and he would not give up his religion or his prophet. Hmm. And there were more than that, too.
Jane, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a fascinating hour.
Thank you for having me.
Jane Barnes. And the book is Falling in Love with Joseph Smith, My Search for the Real Prophet. She was a writer for the PBS series about the Mormons and found this to be a fascinating topic and almost became a Mormon herself. She's the author of several other books, two novels, My Life with Lenin, I, Krupskaya, and Double Lives. And she has written essays and stories for a number of different publications. Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning produced this program. Thanks to both of them. Thanks to you for all of your phone calls. A reminder that we're going to announce the first selection in our Back to School Book Club tomorrow at 10 o'clock. We'll have a fun and interesting reading experience. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network.